1.05 Fabricator Locum. It was a title that carried great honour, but also one that spoke of a substitute, of a man only good enough to take up the position when one more suited was unavailable. Cain struggled against these feelings, knowing that he was as dutiful and diligent a member of the Cult Mechanicum as any, but feeling that he was somehow outside the closed loop of power. In past years, the duty of assisting the Fabricator General with the running of Mars, the meeting of production quotas, and ensuring the correct devotions to the Machine God were observed at all times, had been a rewarding and fulfilling life. Now he spent less and less time with his master, dealing instead with the representatives of the various Legion expeditions as they continually requested more guns, more ammunition, more robots, more everything. A conversation with Strachan had been the final straw. Strachan was Astartes, a warrior of the Salamanders, who represented his Legion's interests on Mars. The Mechanicum held Vulcan's Legion up as an example of how affairs between the two arms of the Imperium should be conducted, their reverence for finely crafted technology making them welcome visitors to Mars. Such relations had become strained in recent days, as Strachan yet again delivered his Primarch's displeasure to the adepts of the Mechanicum. "The lack of armaments and materiel reaching my Primarch's Legion is becoming critical," Strachan had said, when Cain had found time to grant him an audience within his forge, a mighty foundry buried deep beneath the domed hill of Serranius Tholus. "This situation cannot be allowed to continue," said Strachan, without waiting for Cain to answer. "We have no reserves of ammunition beyond that which the forge ships of the Mechanicum contingent attached to our expedition fleet produce. Do you have any idea how much ammunition is expended by a Legion on a war footing?" Cain was all too aware of the staggering rate at which Astartes consumed ammunition, and to think that the Salamanders were eating into the reserves produced by their few forge ships was a damning indictment of the rate of supply. These demands were not unexpected, but recently Cain had noticed a distinct pattern emerging in their nature and frequency, a pattern he now felt moved to report to the Fabricator General. Cain moved through the bright halls of the Olympus Mons Forge Complex, the burnished metal walls lit gold by the fire from the Temple of All Knowledge. Accompanied by a gaggle of servitors and menials, Cain passed through the glittering boulevards of the forge, its majestic immensity a constructed monument to the power of the Mechanicum and of the Fabricator General. Only the Imperial Palace on Terra stood mightier. The inner sanctum of Kelbor Hal was housed within a towering spire that jutted from the northernmost tip of the enormous forge, a peak that almost rivaled the Temple of All Knowledge in height. A host of Skitarii stood to attention at the base of the tower, hulking brutes in gleaming breastplates, cockaded helmets of bronze and fur-lined cloaks. Taller and broader than Cain, these warriors were designed to intimidate, their bearing that of men bred to kill and feel nothing beyond the need for combat. Strength enhancers, metabolic aggression spikes, and pain suppressors were worked into their flesh as augmetics or glanded into their nervous systems, and Cain felt a shiver of nervous anticipation as he approached, reading their spiking adrenal levels in the ambient electrical field. "Fabricator Locum Cain," he canted in a burst of binary, holding his hand out for a biometric scan. It did not matter that the warriors had seen him 1,000 times or more. There were no exceptions to the security protocols surrounding the Fabricator General. The lead Skitarii, a muscular giant, carrying a halberd decorated with all manner of bestial talismans, stepped forward and took Cain's hand. The gesture appeared friendly, but was simply protocol, and Cain felt the man's dendrites mesh with the haptic circuitry within his hand. A green light flickered behind the warrior's eyes, and he processed the information.
"Fabricator Locum Cain," agreed the warrior, releasing Cain's hand and waving him past.
Cain nodded and stepped into the tower's only entrance, a simple portal that led to an apparently empty chamber, sheathed in reflective silver metal with guardrails around its perimeter. As he took his position in the center of the chamber, the floor rotated and began to rise. He called up a gauge onto the inner surface of his eyes, reading the progress of his ascent in binaric numbers that flashed quickly past. As he was conveyed up the length of the spire, Cain regarded his reflection in the rippling silver walls. Cain disliked the ostentation favored by many senior magi and embraced a simpler aesthetic in his appearance. Some called it an affectation, and he allowed that they were probably right. Of average height, Cain carried his augmetics subtly, woven within his flesh or rendered into forms less obvious than was usual on Mars. He wore simple red robes with the icon Mechanicum worked into the fabric in gold thread, and unlike many within the Mechanicum, his face was recognizably human. His hair was cropped close to his skull, his cheekbones finely sculpted, and a hawk-like nose gave him a patrician air he did nothing to discourage. Only the lambent blue glow behind his eyes gave any indication of the many enhancements worked into his skull. At last, the ascent came to an end, and he ceased his vain contemplation of his appearance as the floor rotated 90 degrees until a portal as plain as the one he had recently passed through came into view. Coloured light spilled into the elevator shaft, and he saw the rust-coloured sky now that he was above the perpetual smog of the forge. Taking a moment to compose himself, Cain stepped into the Fabricator General's upper viewing dome. As the Fabricator Locum ascended above the noxious clouds of industry, Dahlia and her colleagues were about to descend. The thrill of having pleased Adept Zeth was still potent in the air, and despite her fear, Dahlia could feel the anticipation of what their mistress was about to show them, fizzing between them all. Caxton held her hand like a young scholem pupil on a field trip, and Severin could not help an irrepressible grin from splitting her features. Zeus was attempting an air of nonchalance, but Dahlia could see that even the laconic machinist was eager to see what lay at the end of their journey. Only Melisyn appeared unmoved, though she had conceded that she was interested in the promise of what Zeth had to show them. The Adept had said little since approving their design for the Theta Wave Enhancer, instructing them to follow her to her inner forge. Dahlia and the others had stood dumbfounded for many moments, unsure as to whether they had heard Zeth's instructions correctly. To see the innermost workings of an Adept's forge was to be granted access to their most private and personal works, their obsessions and their passions. Access to such places was notoriously difficult, and only those who had earned an Adept's utmost favour would ever be allowed to see what lay within. "What do you think this Akashic reader is?" asked Severin, as they wound a twisting course through the gleaming halls of Zeth's forge. "Didn't you tell me that Zeth wanted your help to build it?" "That's what she told me when I first met her," agreed Dahlia, watching the sway of Zeth's golden shoulders and the sachet of her mail cloak as she led them. "But she never told me what it was." "What do you think it is?" inquired Caxton, with a boyish grin. Dahlia shrugged. "Whatever it is, it's something that needs the device we made to work. Perhaps it's some new kind of thinking engine?" That thought had silenced them all. Their journey eventually led them to a high-ceilinged chamber with a barrel-vaulted roof, bereft of ostentation, in the centre of which a silver cylinder, 50 meters wide, rose within the middle vault. A dozen armed servitors gathered around the cylinder, their grey-skinned bodies fused to track units, and their arms replaced with monstrous weapons, surely too large to be borne without suspensers. Dahlia shared anxious looks with the others as the weapons tracked them on their approach to the cylinder. An exchange of rippling binary passed between Zeth and the servitors, and for the briefest second, Dahlia thought she saw darts of light flit through the air towards the servitors.
"Do not be alarmed. The Praetorians will not attack unless I order them to," said Zeth.
"Is this your inner forge?" asked Melisyn,
as the servitors drew back from a slowly opening door in the gleaming walls of the cylinder.
"One of them," offered Zeth.
"Then why only servitors to protect it? Wouldn't it be better to have guards that can think for themselves?"
"A good question," answered Zeth, stepping through the door. "But what I am about to show you is something that benefits from protection by those who cannot gossip."
Dahlia felt the watchful eyes of the servitors upon her, the hairs on the back of her neck rising as she felt their cauterized minds assess her level of threat. She could visualize the simple logic paths of their battle wetware, tiny decision trees that would decide whether the weaponized servitors would ignore her or obliterate her. In her mind's eye, she began evolving that wetware,
building in safeguards, null loops and protection subsystems to avoid any paralyzing logic paradoxes. Lines of golden fire emerging from a fog. "Planning on joining us, Delia?" She looked up, startled by the sound of Caxton's voice. Zeth, Romeo-31, Melisin, Zoosh, and Severin had passed through the door, but the youthful Caxton awaited her, and she smiled, faintly embarrassed to have fallen into one of her technical reveries once more.
"Of course," she said. "I was just thinking."
"Anything as exciting as the Theta Wave Enhancer?" asked Caxton, holding out his hand. She shook her head as she took his hand with a smile.
"No, just ways to improve the wetware of the servitors."
"Really? You're a regular STC system, Dahlia. You know that?"
"Don't tease,"
said Dahlia, stepping through the door with him and feeling a gust of frigid air wash over her. The breath caught in her throat as she found herself standing on what appeared to be a funicular elevator carriage attached to the inner wall of the silver cylinder, which Dahlia now saw was hollow and plummeted down into the darkness. Dahlia squeezed Caxton's hand as a sudden knot of vertigo settled in her stomach. The carriage rails spiraled downwards, and Dahlia closed her eyes in fear as the doors she had just stepped through slid shut behind her.
"You are uncomfortable with this mode of transport?" asked Romeo-31.
"I don't like heights," gasped Dahlia. "I never have."
"Don't worry," said Zoosh. "Can't see the bottom, so you can't tell how high we are."
"That doesn't help," snapped Dahlia. Zoosh shrugged.
"Oh, I thought it might."
"Well, it doesn't, so keep thoughts like that to yourself."
"Just trying to put your mind at ease," grumbled Zoosh. Dahlia yelped as the funicular car began its spiraling descent with a jolt, gaining speed as Zeth pushed out the throttle. Her breath came in short, hiking gulps, the analytical part of her brain processing that the air was cold, far colder than she might have expected, even allowing for the speed they travelled through the echoing, empty space. She kept her eyes shut as the carriage spiralled deeper and deeper into the bowels of Zeth's forge. The air was chill in her lungs, and she opened her eyes to see a cloud of breath misting before her mouth. Cracked white lines of ice were forming on the metal guardrails of the carriage.
"It's cold," said Dahlia. "Look, there's frost on the metal."
"So there is," said Caxton, releasing her hand and wrapping his arm around her.
"Don't you think that's odd?"
"Odd how?"
"We're descending into the planet's surface, or at least below a lagoon of lava, so I'd have thought it would be getting warmer."
Caxton shrugged, giving her shoulder a reassuring squeeze.
"The wonders of the mechanicum, I guess."
Dahlia forced a smile as the car continued on its interminable descent, once again screwing her eyes tightly shut. It seemed they had been travelling for hours, though Dahlia knew it could only have been 10 minutes at the most. Other than the few words she had exchanged with Caxton, the journey was wordless. Yet Dahlia had the distinct impression that someone was speaking to her. She looked over at her fellow travellers. Each was engrossed in the journey, either craning their necks upwards to the spot of light at the top of the cylinder, or leaning over the edges of the railings to penetrate the gloom below. None, however, were speaking. Dahlia squinted in puzzlement as she stared at Adept Zeth and Romeo-31, seeing a ghostly nimbus of light floating above their heads that rippled like a sheet of luminous gauze. Flickering scraps of light darted between Zeth and her protectors, as though they were communicating in some non-verbal manner.
Was she hearing echoes of that communication?
As though aware of the scrutiny, Adept Zeth turned to face her, and Dahlia guiltily turned away, closing her eyes and concentrating on the sounds she had heard. The rumbling of the carriage was loud, yet Dahlia felt she could hear something beyond the squeal of the metal wheels along the rails. Something soft. A whisper of far away, a chorus of commingled voices.
"Do you hear that?"
she asked.
"Hear what?"
asked Caxton.
Those voices." "Voices?"
"No, I don't. But then I can't hear anything much beyond the noise of this elevator," said Caxton. "I wonder when its last maintenance check was." Dahlia fought the urge to snap at him for that remark.
"I swore I could hear somebody whispering. Do any of the rest of you hear it?"
"I hear nothing,"
said Zouche, except that the bearings on this carriage need replacing.
Thanks for that, said Dahlia. Severine? Melisande?
Both women shook their heads, and Dahlia risked a glance over the railings, seeing a change in the texture of darkness below, and realizing that the carriage was approaching the bottom of the shaft. Dahlia caught a glance pass between Rho Mu 31 and Adept Zeth. Though their faces were covered, she could tell from their body language that they knew what she was asking about.
You hear them, don't you? Asked Dahlia. Your hearing is augmented. You must hear it. It's like a thousand voices all whispering at once, but as though they're really far away, or behind a thick wall or something.
Adept Zeth shook her head.
No, Dahlia, I don't hear them, but I know they are there. The reason you hear them is one of the reasons you are so special to me.
What do you mean?
You mean she's right? Asked Zouche. There really are voices here?
In a manner of speaking, said Zeth with a nod, but most people will never hear them.
Why not?
Asked Dahlia, hearing the voices grow louder, like the sound she imagined the waves made on a shoreline, though without any sense of the words they spoke.
Why can I hear them and no one else here can?
The carriage began to slow, coming to a halt at the base of the cylinder with the smallest bump. The ground was floored with marble, threaded with silver and gold wiring that glittered as though alive with current. A number of unremarkable steel doors exited the chamber, but Dahlia's eyes were drawn to a steady pulse of light that spilled through a low archway in one silver wall. She knew in the marrow of her bones that the source of the voices lay beyond it.
All will become clear in time, said Adept Zeth, but save your questions until I have shown you the wonders that lie within my forge.
Kelbor Hal stood at the very edge of the dome with his back to Cain and his hood drawn up over his elongated head. Waving manip arms were poised at his shoulders, and one turned as Cain approached. Beside the Fabricator General was the ebony-skinned automaton of Lucas Crom, its smooth, featureless face turning towards him with apparent curiosity. Cain disliked automatons, as he hated all attempts to mimic the perfection of the human form by mechanical means. As a mark of respect, Crom had also gifted an automaton to Cain the previous year, but he had never activated it, and it remained without power in one of the tech vaults of Mondus Oculum. No, the human condition could be enhanced and augmented with technology, but should never be replicated or replaced by technology. Cain allowed himself a tight smile. The technotheologians of Cydonia Mensae would have a field day with such apparent contradictions inherent in his thoughts. That a man so enhanced by the boons of technology should so resist the inevitable meld of human and machine. He felt the automaton scan his biometrics, reading his identity in the organic portions of his flesh, and his electrical resonance field that was as much a unique signature, if not more so, as any gene print. The Fabricator General was an imposing individual, a figure rendered massively tall by the machine parts and bulky augmetics that had replaced 87.6% of his flesh. Mechadendrites, alive with blades, saws, and myriad other attachments, waved at his back, while innumerable data wheels pulsed within him. Cain wondered how much of a body could be replaced with technology and still be called human. A green glow emanated from within Kelbor Hal's hood, his machine face alive with flickering lights, and his internal structure whirring with activity. Cain knew better than to interrupt whatever cogitations his master was calculating, and cast his gaze through the thick glass over the glorious, sacred soil of Mars. The entire eastern flank of Olympus Mons was laid out before him, layered with tier upon tier of engine houses, forges, docks, ore smelteries and assembly shops that reached from the ground to the very summit of the long-dead volcano. Spires and smokestacks clung to the mountain like a metallic fungus, hives of industry working day and night to provide for the Emperor's armies. Millions toiled in the Fabricator General's domain, from adepts in the highest spires to oil-stained laborers in the lightless depths of the sweltering manufactorum. Those privileged to serve the Fabricator General dwelt in the worker hives that sprawled eastwards for hundreds of kilometers like a slick out towards the corrugated landscape of the Gigas Sulci.
A pall of smoke hung like a fog over the sub-hives of the worker districts, haphazard structures of steel and refuse, bulked out with offcuts and unusable waste from the forges. Beyond the domain of the Fabricator General, the volcanic plateau of Tharsis spread for thousands of kilometres, the landscape scarred by millennia of industry and exploitation. Far to the southeast, Kane could see the monstrous heat haze of Epluvian Maximal's reactor chain and the dense cloud above his forge complex that occupied the ground between the twin craters of Byblis Patera and Ulysses Patera. Kane switched to an enhanced vision mode, filtering out the distortion and increasing his magnification until he could see the Tharsis Montes chain of volcanoes beyond Maximal's forge. The northernmost and largest of the gigantic mountains was Ascreus Mons, a towering geological edifice that was home to Legio Tempestus. The middle mountain in the chain was Pavonis Mons, a brooding peak that aptly reflected the character of Legio Mortis, the Titan Legion that made its fortress within its dour, ashen depths. Furthest south was Arsia Mons, a perpetually smoke-wreathed volcano that had been brought back from dormancy by Adept Coriel Zeth to serve her magma city, which lay on the southern flank of the mountain. Far beyond the Tharsis Montes, the ground rose up sharply in a series of sheer escarpments before dropping down towards the vast expanse of the Syria Plenum. Lucas Crom's Mondus Gamma Forge complex occupied the southern swathe of this broken, desolate landscape, though even an adept as hungry to expand his domain as Crom did not dare build in the plain's northern reaches. There the landscape fell away, appearing to crumble into a series of maze-like canyons, steep-walled grabens, and shadowed valleys. Said to have been created by volcanic activity in eons past, this was the Noctis Labyrinthus, a darkened region of steep valleys whose depths were never warmed by the sun. For reasons not fully understood and never articulated, the adepts of Mars had shunned the Noctis Labyrinthus, preferring to build their forges beneath extinct volcanoes or within the bowls of vast impact craters. Kane's forge, known as Mondus Oculum, lay hundreds of kilometres to the northeast of Ascreus Mons, a vast network of manufactories and weapons shops spread between the domed mountains of Ceraunius Tholus and Tharsis Tholus. The vast majority of his forge's resources went into the production of war materiel for the Astartes, and they never ceased manufacture. A sighing whir of data wheels spooling down told Kane that the Fabricator General had finished his deliberations. He turned from the view across the plains of Tharsis and made the sign of the Icon Mechanicum towards his master.
"Kane," said Kelbor Hal, "you are unscheduled."
"I know, my lord," replied Kane, "but a matter has arisen that I felt compelled to bring to your attention."
"Felt? An irrelevant term," said Kelbor Hal. "Either the matter requires my attention, or it does not. Which is it?"
Kane read his master's impatience in the modulation of his cant and pressed on.
"It is a matter of some urgency and does indeed require your attention," confirmed Kane.
"Then explode the issue swiftly," ordered Kelbor Hal. "I am scheduled to meet with Melgator in 8.3 minutes.
"Ambassador Melgator?"
inquired Kane, intrigued despite himself. He disliked Melgator, knowing the man had few pretensions of pursuing the quest for knowledge over his own quest for influence and power.
"What business is the ambassador about these days?"
"The ambassador will be acting as my emissary to ensure the loyalty of the forges of Mars," said the Fabricator General.
"Surely such a thing is not in question,"
said Kane, horrified that a sycophant like Melgator would judge the loyalty of his fellow adepts.
"In such troubled times, nothing can be counted on as certain," replied Kelbor Hal. "But do not concern yourself with affairs beyond your remit, Fabricator Locum. Tell me of the matter you bring before me."
Kane bit back an angry retort at the undue binary emphasis his master placed on his subordinate title and said,
"It's the legions, my lord. The Astartes cry out for supplies, and we are failing to meet their requirements."
"Long have we known that the supply situation for many of the Legion fleets would be troublesome," replied Kelbor Hal. "Given the distances the fleets are operating from Mars, supply problems were a mathematical certainty. You should have anticipated this and made contingencies."
I have done so, said Cain, irritated that his master would think he might make such a basic error in his computations. The Mechanicum has done its utmost to meet those challenges, but they are impossible to overcome completely. As the fleets operate at ever greater distances, the failings in the system only compound themselves.
Failings? Snapped Kelbor Hal. I designed the system myself. It is a logic-based scheme of supply and demand, without room for error or misunderstanding.
Cain knew he was on dangerous ground and hesitated before he spoke again.
With respect, my lord, it is a scheme that does not factor in every variable. There is a human factor that introduces random elements that cannot be accounted for.
A human element, repeated Kelbor Hal.
The hiss of binary contained a vehement disparagement in its code, as though the Fabricator General would be happier without such elements altogether.
It is always the human element that skews calculations. Too many elements of chaotic variability alter the outcome in ways too numerous to predict. It is no way to run a galaxy.
My lord, if I may,
said Cain, knowing that his master was prone to tangential discourses on the fallibility of human nature. Kelbor Hal nodded.
Continue.
As I said, the issue of supplying the legions has always been problematic, but recently I have identified a pattern within the structure that appears too often to be a coincidence.
A pattern? What pattern?
Cain hesitated, reading a spike of interest register in the Fabricator General's binaric field.
Where we might reasonably expect those legions operating closest to Mars to have the fewest supply problems, that's not what I'm seeing.
Then what are you seeing?
That the legions without supply problems are those acting in direct support of the War Master.
Beyond the archway lay Coriel Zeth's inner forge, and Dahlia had never seen anything like it. Hewn from the bedrock of Mars and 600 meters in diameter, the forge was a perfectly hemispherical cavern, clad in silver metal. The curving walls were a latticework of coffers, each filled with a human being plugged with ribbed cables and copper wires.
There's hundreds of them, breathed Severine.
Dahlia's skin crawled at the sight of so many people, fixed into the very fabric of the walls and ceiling of the dome. Knowing that Severine was wrong, there were thousands of people fitted into the alcoves. The apex of the dome was a metallic disc that burned with light and from which crackling golden lines radiated around the chamber, like information ghosting along fiber-optic cables as they passed from coffer to coffer. The fiery lines all eventually reached the ground, carried from the walls along the wires, embedded in the marble flooring, towards a figure who sat like a king upon a golden throne raised on a dais of polished black granite. Glittering silver devices with parabolic dishes projected from the cardinal points of the elliptical walls, all of which were aimed towards the convergence of energy at the raised throne. It was towards this solitary figure that Zeth marched, flanked by Romeo 31 and followed by Dahlia and her fellows. Dahlia felt a crackling charge in the air, as though a powerful generator was pumping out megawatts of power, but she could see nothing in the chamber that would produce such an output. For the forge of an adept as senior as Coriel Zeth, it was strangely empty, though what it contained was no less strange for that fact. As Dahlia made her way to the center of the chamber, she looked into the faces of the nearest figures encapsulated within the coffers and sealed in by glossy, translucent membranes. For all intents and purposes, they were identical. Thin and wasted, their muscles were stretched over their skeletons as though pulled too tightly across their bones. Clad in simple robes that might once have been green, the figures were held immobile by silver manacles and pipes that writhed with an undulating, peristaltic motion.
Are they servitors?
Asked Severine, her voice hushed.
Course they are,
said Zush, showing no such restraint in volume.
What else would they be? Stands to reason, doesn't it?
I'm not sure, whispered Melisande. These aren't servitors, said Dahlia,
now seeing what Melisande had noticed. One other feature unified the figures bound into the alcoves, a strip of white cloth bound over their sunken eye sockets.
Then what are they? Demanded Zush.
They're psychers,